Onverse Review episode. The Neutral Zone and a Romulan. Jean-Luc Picard tries to stop a war. Things are so dire, we can't trust any other guy. We're gonna tell you how we're feeling about this particular episode. For our first review, Scott's the selector, so we're watching the show. Defector doesn't make most lists, but Scott loves it, so we're watching the show. Defector.
Sci-Fi Melody, symptom 137, The Defector. Rage Master with a fantastic lead-in once again. I don't know how he constantly comes up with these, but he does. And hats off to you. You are an endless fount of creativity. Yes, we are starting off this week with The Defector. It doesn't make many lists. I do love this episode, and I'm going to be quite honest with you. If I was giving in to my guilty pleasures, I would rate this higher, much higher, within this countdown of four.
Wait a minute, Scott. I got a question for a friend of mine.
Well, I'm going to get to that.
Okay.
Why is the inner light not in here?
Yes, why is the inner light not in here?
So let me spoil this for a second and tell you the other episodes that will be in here. The Best of Both Worlds has to be. It is in here. Tapestry is going to be in here. And The Measure of a Man. So starting with The Inner Light.
Yeah, is that a bad episode? Is it a bad episode to you?
It's a phenomenal episode. It's one of the best pieces of science fiction and studies of the human equation that Next Generation or Star Trek has ever done. It's a wonderful piece about a dying civilization. Picard experiences an entire life with a son and a family and a wife and grandkids. And he experiences it all in 20 minutes and he carries that memory with him. And he has trouble adapting back to that life because he feels he's lived there for 40 years. Lived and died. And watched loved ones die. And a probe is there basically to give them something of the civilization to carry on. The only flaw I can come out with is somehow the alien civilization happens to look like desert-dwelling Americans. And is Picard just experiencing them in that way because it relates to him? And if so, then did he really get any aspect of their culture? It seems far too much like humanity to be a real thing. But setting that aside, that was probably done to make it more accessible. It doesn't ruin the episode. Why is it not on here? Because it's a 10 out of 10 as a piece of Star Trek and a piece of science fiction. Because it's not indicative of the series as a whole. If I was going to show someone an episode of Star Trek to get them to watch more episodes of Star Trek and try to give them something most representative of the seven seasons at a whole at its best, I would not choose Inner Light the same way I did not choose The City on the Edge of Forever, because neither of those episodes are really similar to anything else the show does. You can go through all seven seasons and The Inner Light is a standout, and it's something very, very different. And every time I watch it, it doesn't feel like a Star Trek show. It feels like Patrick Stewart guest starring as someone who might be Jean-Luc Picard in another TV show.
But it's still worth my time to watch that episode.
Absolutely. You should watch it. You should absolutely watch it. You're going to love it. It's a phenomenal piece of Star Trek. I have nothing negative to say about it.
Again, you can watch all seven seasons without any problem. But I understand where you're coming from. Is you're choosing four episodes that are indicative of the show as a total, and then picking the four best, in your opinion, to show someone and say, this is what Star Trek Next Gen is.
Exactly.
I don't know. I think Scott would be okay with us skipping Code of Honor.
Code of Honor is terrible. It's an absolutely horrible episode. And I mean, the actors didn't even want to finish it. The director was fired mid-shoot and never asked back.
Yeah. So there are episodes of Next Gen that are worth skipping.
A lot of them are in the first season.
And that Code of Honor was what, second season, I think?
No, it was first season, third episode. Yeah, Encounter at Farpoint, The Naked Now, and Code of Honor.
It very quickly you get to some of the...
All right. Yeah. That, which is unfortunate, because how many people saw that episode and went, and done?
Yeah, absolutely. It's amazing that the show got through the first season. Now, I'm going to get some other things out of the way right now. Yes, I'm going to do a supplemental on the full top 10 list or top 11 list like I did with TOS. and talk about the things that didn't make it, because there's some great episodes in there. And I'm going to just talk right now about the three or four that I think people will scream loudest about that I did not include. Yesterday's Enterprise. It makes most lists. It gives you a much more satisfying ending to the Tasha Yar story. It's a Mirror Universe story. It's a good Mirror Universe story. But I think if you want to talk about a war story and a military story, the one we're doing today is better. Now, people might not agree with me. Some people might say it's got Shooter McGavin in it. It's got the Enterprise C. It's well acted. It's a great episode. And if we were doing five, it would be there. If I was doing a top five, it would be there. It just missed. And I decided to throw the Defector in over Yesterday's Enterprise, because if I can only watch one, I would watch the Defector.
And I know this was a tricky choice for you, because you were really taking your time over and
pondering this for months.
About 8 months.
You were constantly kind of like, I went no, and then yes, and then, and it's like this final list took you a lot of time to get to.
Q-Hoo is the first great, second great episode of Next Gen. Measure of a Man is probably the first. But Q-Hoo is where Q throws the Enterprise into Borg space territory, and they meet the Borg for the first time. It is one of the finest episodes that John DeLancey is in. Ultimately, I threw that one out because I think Tapestry is a better Q episode, because it's season six. John DeLancey has a full grasp on the character. Patrick Stewart has a full grasp on his character. And they've worked that dynamic between the two to the point that, in my mind, Tapestry hits at its highest levels of that Picard-Q dynamic. I think it's Q at his best. And it also is a better role for Q. He's not in there as the god of mischief. And he's not in there as someone just playing games with the crew. He's teaching Picard a lesson. In this case, he is the benevolent super being who's trying to prod humanity along the way into the right path, and particularly Picard. It also gives you a big insight into Picard's backstory, and there's a wonderful message and moral about life and your mistakes in it. And I think ultimately, on all levels, it's the better, more entertaining episode, albeit slightly, but it's a very good one. And of course, Darmok. Darmok and Jalad at Tanagra, Shaka when the walls fell, Timba, his arms wide, the river Tamor in winter. It's the aliens that only speak in metaphor. It's a really good episode. There are flaws with the episode, and as you rewatch it over and over and over again,
like he does,
some of those flaws start to break that episode. Darmok is something that the first time you watch it, it's a 10. The 75th time you watch it, it's down to an 8 or a 9. It's a very good episode, but eventually, a species that only can communicate in metaphor, bashes you over the head and you go, this doesn't make sense, and it starts to break what's in there in the episode.
The more you look in the mirror, the dirtier the mirror appears.
Yeah, it never becomes a bad episode. And then there's other things like the Drumhead, which is one of my guilty pleasures, but it's a good episode that rates as an 8 that I considered for this. And there's a lot more, and I'll go through that list in full. But those are the three big ones. You know, an Iborg, maybe people would say that might have made the list, but those are the three big ones. I chose the episodes I did specifically for reasons. So let's get into this episode of The Defector and why I chose this.
Sorry to Rickroll you sickies, by the way. I kind of am. I'm kind of not. But that being said.
Well, this is going to be more of a serious month, so we need to get the humor out in the intros.
Yeah, I guess so.
This is my month where I dig into deep issues in the study of humanity.
Well, that's Star Trek for you.
Yeah, let's just do this now then, so we don't have to do it till the end.
The whole episode.
Yeah.
Hey, let me finish. This month is Scott's deep meaning.
That's exactly right. So, why did I choose this episode? This comes down to, for me, this is the quintessential portrayal of Jean-Luc Picard, the man, the quintessential portrayal of Jean-Luc Picard, the leader. You don't get a more clear picture of who he is than watching this episode.
He's in a Kobayashi Maru in this episode, really.
And he's never out of control. He's never outmaneuvered. But this tells you, you see his military leadership style. He's going to outmaneuver his opponent before he outfights his opponent. You see his leadership style to his team. He cares for them. He wants to share their fate and their danger, but he knows he can't because he has to maintain that distance.
But he also does the whole mutually assured destruction at the end, too.
Yeah.
He's like, yeah, I might lose, but so will you.
Right.
And I'll avert the war because I already have the dirt on you. Right. And we already sent that. So this will just be a small skirmish that we both walked away from. We both died for nothing.
Right. You see the caring side of Picard, because he wants to make sure that if he's going to sacrifice his crew, the cause be just. And he has to be convinced that it is. You see the steel in Picard when he's talking to Admiral Zhurak. And Admiral Zhurak tries to hit him with his biggest thing about, you know, you must change the world for children. She will believe her father's a traitor, but she will grow up if you help me stop this war. And everyone else has been tiptoeing around this with him. Gently, you know, Riker's like, forgive me here, but aren't you defecting? And Data's like, it's unlikely you'll ever return home. Everyone's tiptoeing. Picard just hits him with it. You're a traitor, sir. You are a traitor. You've made your choices. You know? And he tells him to stomach that pill. And then he says, I can't and I won't unless I have unequivocal cooperation. Zhurak, this whole time, is trying to give them just enough information to show up and make them take down the base and avert the war without hurting and putting the Romulans in a negative spot. Yeah, Picard says you can't half do this.
But Zhurak seems to also know that the sacrifice he's making, when Data takes him into the holodeck to show him his homeland, and he says it's a fast, he loves it, but then says, take it away. I'm never going to see it again. It was torture for him because he realized I'm in this for real. So,
well, this is the thing about it. When I'm watching it, I see, yes, the character is tortured and has lost his home world, lost, you know, all that made him, you know, Romulan in some ways. But this is the other thing where I'm watching it and I also look at this character like, he doesn't seem like a Romulan at times.
Well, yeah, you know,
because I'm sorry, but I'm watching this character and he's supposed to be this admiral. I'm like, dude, you don't seem like you are acting like what an admiral in the Romulan. This, because again, you would have had to years within the Romulan military to be like hardened and totally not care about something like this and be like, who cares?
Well, that's. That's, you know, a few things to that. One, I guess, is that this tries to show the, you know, and if ages ago, we complained about how sometimes in sci-fi, you just make a monoculture, that every alien acts this way, when we know darn well that, yeah, maybe there is a bunch of Marklars out there, but then there's also not. And so maybe that's one angle they want to show that. You know, much like the Klingons, where not everybody's some kind of hyper warrior. Well, not everyone in the Romulan Empire is like that.
Well, I get that, but my only counter to that would be this: you would weed that out. But well, before you make it to Admiral, you would weed that out and be like, "This guy's not fit."
You would think, but that doesn't mean. I mean, he got to that point, that massacre. Obviously, he's someone who was willing to do it, but then, for what I think he considered, he mentions in there, I saw the face of my daughter.
Right.
And that could, you know, when you become, none of us are parents, so we cannot say for sure, but everybody knows that unless you are one of those really selfish people that, I'll go ahead and say it, a piece of garbage that just hates your kids and throws them out because you don't like them. Having kids changes you. It does change your view of things. And even if you stay a warmonger, it changes your perspective on it. And then third, remember that the Cuban Missile Crisis was averted by a Soviet naval captain who said, I don't really want to start a nuclear war. I don't see. And so why couldn't this guy do the same thing? Up until that moment, I'm sure that naval captain was a hardcore Soviet. And probably still was afterwards, because this admiral kept saying, I'm for the Empire. He was not a traitor. He had no intention of, he didn't want to give up secrets when they kept asking, what's your troop compliment? Irrelevant. What's this? Irrelevant. every time they wanted military secrets, he was like, no, I'm not telling you that. I'm just telling you this one to save the Empire and nothing else.
Right. And I agree with you in many aspects. My only issue was, again, looking at this character sometimes, he seems conflicted and in a different way than just conflicted because he's looking at his kid and figuring. I'm saying it seems like the character and seems to sometimes be Romulan 100%, and other times seems to be. And again, I know this is Star Trek, so we're supposed to sometimes
have nuance.
Well, nuance, and also when we look at a character, be able to put ourselves into that character. So, hence why sometimes
the aliens are us today.
Right. Hence why I look at it and go, oh, obviously that character now looks very human. And that's why I'm like, sometimes he doesn't. He's playing a very Romulan character and then playing us.
The Romulans are supposed to be the schemers, they're supposed to be the people who want to look for an advantage. They don't want to commit and be the aggressors. They want to be able to manipulate you into the actions that they want to take. But there's more to this Admiral Xerox character, and I think it also ties back into the Henry V Open in listen to what Shakespeare's telling you about the man and a king who wants to share the fate if the cause be just. If the cause be just. Admiral Xerox talks about the Norcan campaigns and what they call the Norcan massacres that he calls the Norcan campaigns. And it's trite, but one world's butcher is another world's hero. Mm-hmm. So you've got this guy who's been a bloody warrior, their best warrior. He's the Romulan's Romulan. He's their hero, you know? But he's had his fill. And what pushes him over the edge, he's watched his men die for no good reason. And now he sees his daughter. And he wants to make sure that that next generation isn't going to die for no good reason. This is a man who's still willing to fight for a cause. But he doesn't see any point in fighting the Federation. Doesn't think it can be won. Doesn't think it's worth the cost. Doesn't think it's worth the blood. And it's clashing with his patriotism. It's clashing with his indoctrination. But he's found motivations in people, in Romulanness, in humanity. So it's really supposed to be to say, is this war worth it? And it ties back into the whole motif of if the cause be just. Tom Locke doesn't care. Xerox says, my cause is no longer just. The just cause is peace. And I think when you look into the motivations of Xerox, he still wants to be a patriot. He still wants a strong, healthy, undefeated empire. And it's why he doesn't want to betray anything. It's why he blows up his scout ship. It's why he doesn't want to give any information away or help. But it comes back to when he's in the holodeck with Data. And Data says, you can stay here as long as you want. And what Xerox realizes at that time is, I can stay in my fantasy. This is my literal fantasy. And I can stay in this fantasy that I can get this done without giving away all the information I need to. And as Picard says, dance on the head of a pin on the neutral zone. Or I can accept the reality of the situation, which is that I have crossed the lines, tell him everything I know, and do what I have to do to make sure all of this wasn't for nothing. Or, as Data said, you can stay in this fantasy as long as you want to. And at that point, when he says, shut it off, that's him making the mental decision to say, whatever reservations I had left must be released.
Fair enough.
And then Picard hits him with a sledgehammer.
Right. Now, my question is, and I could be completely off base here. We are looking at him and saying he's going for the just cause. And Picard's just cause is to prevent a war? Because it at times it seems like he's going for a military advantage.
Picard's just cause is harder to ascertain here, and I actually thought about this. What Picard is trying to do, it's what Xerox says at the beginning to Riker and Worf. The Federation's not going to stand by and let you establish a base in the neutral zone. And Xerox goes, then it means war. So Picard is willing to make this first strike and stain his hands. Because by doing that, he can prevent the Romulans from establishing a base, and then the standoff occurs again, and the status quo is maintained. So Picard's just cause is preventing a war. And Picard is also willing to risk his crew to stop that loss of life. But at the same time, he gets a little gray because he says, I can't and I won't risk my crew. Right. Unless you give him the unequivocal cooperation, because he's going to say, your sacrifice.
Right. This is
all of that doesn't mean anything to me unless I can protect and guarantee my people are fighting for the right cause.
This is why I was very confused at times with his just cause, because I was like, he seems gray, and for sure, and he's also at points going, I would say, beyond preventing a war, because he's about to start a war. I mean,
in his mind, the only way to start the war is to destroy the base.
Yeah, and that's why I'm saying he's starting a war.
It's if he destroys the base, the Romulans will deny knowledge of it, and it'll just be a diplomatic, you know, flare-up that needs to be solved.
Again, that could be, or you could, again, this is the problem we have today. I mean, there's no way you can't go, and again, because this is supposed to be like today, there's no way you can look at that action and go, oh, it would just be a diplomatic incident. It could absolutely be the next Romulan Earth War because of Federation Romulan War, because, again, you don't know.
Well, and then you see...
That's the great...
I think you see where Picard's endgame was. I said this at the beginning. Mark, you said this is Picard's Kobayashi Maru.
Well, yeah, because he's in a situation where he can do nothing and assume this guy's lying. And if he's right, well, great. He averted a war. He averted an action that could lead to war. If he's wrong, then the Federation gets caught with its pants down.
Mm-hmm.
Or he can act and stop this, or lead and do an action that leads to war. There is no perfect option here. In his, at least at as of his reckoning, at the moment, until he realizes the real game that's going on, there's no real win-win action here.
Not to mention, if there is a base there, it's highly unlikely that the Enterprise by itself is going to be able to destroy it and not get destroyed.
Right.
There's a good chance he's charging into his death.
Dumb question. Apparently, since the Klingons could not be detected by the Romulans, couldn't you have just sent a cloaked Klingon ship in to investigate if there was a...
Well, you know...
I'm sorry.
That's a flaw.
I'm willing to hand wave that away. Because here's the thing. I said at the beginning, one of the reasons I chose this is because it demonstrates the leadership of Picard in a lot of different ways. And it highlights the differences between him and Sisko, who just would have went in guns blazing, firing blind at everything. That scene with Sisko and Tomalak would have ended with Sisko saying, take your best shot, and just firing torpedoes first.
Okay? Was Sisko like that from the get-go?
Yes. Sisko punches Q in the face in like the sixth episode.
Yeah.
Well, you did say towards the end of DS9, it turns into Worf punches somebody and something blows up.
Sisko destroys something. You know, Sisko's first reaction to everything is to go on the offensive and fight.
All right, well,
I love Sisko. He's a great, great character. He's very different.
Yeah, he's also more of the military leader.
Yes, the most realistic military leader of them all.
Right, well, because that's the general you would want in charge in battle.
Absolutely.
He's a Patton.
Yep. Sisko's Patton.
Yeah, because that's the guy you want leading the charge.
One who arranges the assassination of a Romulan senator to bring the Romulans into the war.
All right. Well, God willing.
Yeah. We'll get to that next year. We'll do
that next January.
Yes. Anyway, I chose this because it contrasts him and Kirk. Look no further back than the Corbinite maneuver. Kirk is not in control in that spot. And his anger comes out. He snaps at McCoy. And while he tries to keep the ship calm, he's full of emotion. And when he's talking to Balak, he raises his voice. You know, Kirk is not in control of that situation. He flies by the seat of his pants and finds a way out. When Kirk faces the Kobayashi Maru, he cheats and finds a way out. Picard's in a real-life Kobayashi Maru. If he goes to where he has to go, he's going to be outnumbered and destroyed. If he doesn't go, lots of lives are going to be lost. His solution, then, is to outmaneuver and envelop his enemy. And so he charges in there, looks weak, gets the Klingons to surround it, and it's like playing Go. It's not even chess. It's Go. He's encircled his opponent.
Yeah, he's not playing... Again, he's doing something different, because he's looking, again, I agree with you, because he's doing this move by A, looking like he's going for the move that obviously is the most obvious and the Romulans think he's going for.
Mm-hmm.
But he's also then doing the opposite in a way, because he's not, while he's playing into their hand, he's taking the other hand and playing around them.
Yep.
So it's
and
like,
my reading of this episode is Picard figured out everything that was going on about the time he told Worf to take that incoming call and he handled that.
Yeah.
They gave you the useless secrets. I think the information was all there. And Picard had it and he put together at that point.
I would agree with you because, again, when you first look at it and see, again, the Romulans almost retreating right away, not putting up any kind of...
And Geordi points out they could have overtaken the ship three times.
Right. It's like very obvious when you take a step back, again, from knowing the end and knowing everything, taking a step back and going, oh, that doesn't make sense. Yep. And it's also an obvious setup.
He knows his enemy and he knows it's the Romulans and that when they're outmaneuvered, they will flee. But I love that scene because Tomalak thinks he's in control. And it's grating at him that Picard the whole time isn't perturbed. He's not sweating. You know, he's just, if an apology will do, I offer it. He's like, get to the point, Tomalak.
Yeah.
And he's never not in
control of
that.
I give you 30 seconds. I don't need one.
Right. That's perfect. I do not require one. And then, you know, I urge you, Captain Picard, think of the men and women you will lead to death in a lost cause.
It's almost like Tomalak's thinking, oh, God, don't do this. I just want to win.
I watch this and I really, this is geeky, but I get butterflies when I watch this scene because he's just sitting there and he says, the cause be just. And he says, they're willing to die. Well, are you willing to die?
These are the actions of a man who knows he has the upper hand. He just hasn't revealed it yet.
No. And Tomalak is like, it's that great point. He goes, I expected more from you than an idle threat. And he goes, then you shall have it.
Yeah. Well, there's also the bit where, again, I think Tomalak is, again, he knows the enemy he's facing. Hence why I think, again, let's be honest, the Romulans and the Federation know each other. So they know what they should be facing. So when he's talking to Picard, he's like, why on earth am I not getting anything out of this guy? I should be getting fear. I should be getting something. Why is he responding this way? Why is he calm? What is going on?
And then he starts walking him down and he's, you still will not survive our attack. He's like, and you will not survive ours. Shall we die together?
Right.
The cold, cool British for a French captain. Just
the stiff
bad.
Upper,
I want to swear, you know, but it's just one of those bad moments where
the stiff upper lip of a Frenchman. Wait, what?
There is more menace in that whole scene and delivery than you get out of Kirk or Sisko at almost any time. There's just this cold calculation. He's not bluffing. He's not bluffing. No. And another nice touch was playing the Klingon theme music from the motion picture when the Klingons decloak.
You know what? I want to say, talk about that, because that to me is an example of fine writing in this episode. Now, I'm not, before we go, don't derail too much, but do you know exactly why the Klingons were willing to help? Is that ever explained? Did I miss that? Or is it because Worf called in a favor?
There's been a favor called in. There's arcs going on, but we haven't really gotten to the point where Picard has acted as the arbiter of succession for Gowron yet. But the Klingons and the Federation are on very good terms. So they were able, Worf didn't call the favor in, but the Federation.
Okay, but Worf was able to mediate that, which is why I assumed Picard said, will you handle that?
Right.
So, and that's the kind of thing where I understand if we're comparing that to more modern writing where explanations are not given, just exposition, exposition without explanations. That's one where you don't need it, where it's assumed somebody called in a favor and that's good enough for us. Because by that point, if you've been watching the show, you realize, well, even if you've never seen the show, you assume, well, they must be buddies. And they call in a favor. That's it. I don't need more of an... I can make that conclusion in my head.
Or
it's not like, wait, where did the Emperor get a bunch of Death Star Star Destroyers?
Well,
I don't need an... I need an explanation for that. That's too much of a stretch.
Well, also, I think it's very easily acceptable because you can also go, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
That's
it, too. The Klingons and the Romulans are blood enemies.
And that, too. If you know that.
Right.
But even if you don't know that, like I said, even if you're just jumping into this episode, like I did, well, okay, obviously, they must be buddies, and they called in a favor. Okay, fine. And the Klingons, for whatever reason, have a vested interest in seeing this not conflagrate. So, but that's great how they show that He walks off, and you know something's going to happen. You just don't know what.
Right.
And then they bring this in, and the as you said, the music, that's a nice touch of editing. And then in the beginning, when the Admiral pulls out that, well, it's a little piece of cardboard.
The Phlogiston chip.
Yeah. But you don't know what that is. But you know, assume at the beginning, well, it's some kind of data chip.
It's a good Chekhov's gun.
It is. But it's used later. And you realize, oh, well, actually, it makes sense why he would use that.
Yeah. But again, I know a little bit about Star Trek where I know the Klingons and the Romulans are enemies. So for me, it made total sense. I'm like, oh, yeah. All the Federation had to do was go, hey, we're about to screw over the Romulans.
And to send a few birds of prey to stop a war that with enemies you hate anyway. Yeah, all right.
Yeah. The Klingons are disappointed they didn't get to fight.
Well, yeah, but also,
the most dangerous thing there was would the Klingons jump the gun and start firing anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, but again, you can just say if we get into a war with the Romulans, we might lose, and then you would have to face a stronger enemy.
One of the other things I didn't talk about was at the beginning of that scene when the Romulans decloak and start firing, and Picard not even panicking yet.
Yeah.
It is just a tap on the shoulder, Mr. Worf.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Worf's like, now, sir?
the shields are going down. Shields.
On the lighter side of things, go back and rewatch the episode when Picard starts talking to Tomalak and he's about to reveal his hand. Watch the crap-eating grin on Riker's face. As it's going down, he's watching Picard and he's just cheesing and grinning. And it's, but the other reason, I said there were multiple reasons I chose this episode. One was it's this excellent portrayal of Picard. He's going to outthink you. He's going to outmaneuver you. He's in control of the situation. Even when he's not in control of the situation, you know, he's going to show that steel and that composure. Doesn't get rattled. He doesn't get flustered. When he does, it's calculated for a speech. And then you see the side, as I said, that he gets tough with Admiral Zhirok, and he's not afraid to pull the punches, and he dominates that scene. But it also shows you Patrick Stewart's acting at its finest. In the TOS countdown, I tried to show you good episodes of William Shatner's acting, where he was on high display of his skill
and not chewing the scenery constantly. Yeah.
Patrick Stewart has to play a tough role here as Picard. He's got to play. He's the concerned captain who's trying to show the viewers in the audience that he cares about his crew and that he doesn't want to sacrifice their lives. And he realizes that the trust they put in him that, you know, at the beginning, if his cause be wrong, our obedience to the king wipes the sin out of us. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to make sure that he's making the decision so that his men are covered. They're going to follow him. So he owes them to make sure that he's leading them correctly on a just cause and taking right actions. He's also got to be the disconnected, distant leader, and he can't walk among his crew. So he's got to play that. He's got to show you that side, which he does in his conversations with Data, who he can let his guard down to. And then he's got to show you the tough side, which he does everywhere else. That's a tough line to walk as an actor, and Stewart is masterful at it. You also get to see him in the opening scene as the other guy in the holodeck, playing opposite of Data under some heavy makeup and a big backcountry accent. And You guys didn't know it was him.
No,
I pointed out to you guys that it was him.
He hit it well.
Yeah, I had to listen. As you said, listen. Then you can hear it. But if you just are not paying attention and don't know what you're looking for, you can easily pass that up.
And Stewart requested that. He went out of his way to say, I want that part.
Well,
he's a Shakespearean trained
actor, of course. Yep.
Yeah. Hey, man, that's going back to his roots against Shakespeare. Like, oh, yeah, I get to do some Shakespeare? Count me in.
But this is where you see Patrick Stewart, the actor. I mean, it's hard to find shows where, you know, episodes where he's acting at a higher level than here. And that's a lot for Patrick Stewart.
Absolutely. You know? Because, again, I think, again, he's playing almost the quintessential commander role in this. Because, again, as you said, he's playing the role of being a distant leader, which, let's be honest, every general has to. Because you can't look and go, I'm sending 10,000 soldiers over the top and I can't think how many people are dying. I need to think, am I going to complete the mission? I can't say, oh, I can't do the mission. I can't send the soldiers because they might die. I can't. And he's doing that. But he's also being the general, which every general should be, of I cannot do this. I cannot send men into battle to die unless A, the war is just, obviously, and B, I have some insurance that there might be their die for cause. Even if the war is not just, there is the cause that they might win the battle, we might win the war, or something. There must be a reason for the loss. And again, he's showing that. And you're right, because he is the quintessential general in this, and showing both sides. And he does a very good job of showing it.
So we've talked about Picard's just cause. Let's talk about Admiral Jarok. And I want to add that, you know, when you look for these best episodes, sometimes you try to find really strong guest performances, and James Sloyan as Alador Jarok is phenomenal. It takes a very good actor to hold his own in a scene against Patrick Stewart, and he more than holds his own in that scene. I mean, it's tough to get out there against opposite of Patrick Stewart and not come out getting out-acted and put in the corner. And he does a fantastic job in that spot. So, I mean, you get some of the best guest acting in this scene that you'll see in the series. Not the best, but very good guest acting. And it's hard to get that in a TV show sometimes. Did Admiral Jarok make a right choice? Was his cause just? Could he have stopped anything? Was his sacrifice worth anything? And follow me out on this, because let's say that he's right, and that all the information was correct, and the Romulans are setting up a base in the neutral zone on Nilvana 3 to stage a war. He defects. Picard and the Federation come in, catch the Romulans with their pants down, as Geordi says, which we'll get back to that in a little bit here when we get in our last topic. And they destroy the base, and the Romulans have to pretend they knew nothing about it, and they have to retreat, and they don't start this war. Has he stopped anything? The senior leadership on Romulus, the senior leadership in the military that authorized this, is still in power. They're going nowhere.
Right.
Stops them from trying again in 8 months?
I was about to bring that. I'm glad you went there, because I was going to bring this up. Because my thought was, if he does defect and you're right, everything proves out right. Oh, congratulations, you destroyed a base for 5 seconds. They were just going to build another one, and they want a war. If he's right, they want war. So what's he stopped? War for maybe a few months? Maybe? Or he started the war. One of the two options. Either he started the war or he postponed it.
Yeah.
He did not do anything else. Because again, as long as the Romulan leadership's in charge, they want, and again, if we are assuming he's got good information, they want war. They want it. So there's going to be war. Period.
You don't stop the Civil War by stopping the attack on Fort Sumter. You push it off.
Yeah.
And he's not stopping anything here if there's really a war coming.
I'm not sure the answer.
You're going to be the contrarian for the contrarian's sake?
Wait. Devil's advocate? What?
No, because I'm not the regular devil's advocate. Since Scott's the mediator here, someone has to do that. No, I'm not going to be contrarian. I'm just going to point out the contrarian point because I really don't know. I suppose that it would be a case of, and correct me if I'm wrong, there was supposed to be a base there because the Admiral expressed his concern about that.
Yes, but the base was never real. It was fake timetables and reports. It was all
right. No. What was it that he was complaining about the high command that got him shoved to that quiet sector?
He wanted a less militant stance towards the Federation.
Right, but there was something going on that he voiced his concern. So
got him censured, got him moved away. Yeah, he had just been agitating too much for a less aggressive stance against the Federation.
You're talking about a man who knows his people intimately and knows the military intimately. And as Data points out, the Romulans are kind of cowardly in that, and we see this even in Enterprise, they'll strike, but they'll do it in a way that makes it look like it's not them.
They're like a paramilitary organization that wants to operate in the shadows.
They want to go up and slap you in the head while you're not looking and then sneak away and hope you hit back so they can say it was your fault. And so the idea of them launching a bunch of ships into Federation space being the aggressor. Now, could they have taken a stance, a change in that stance? Yeah, it's possible. But is it likely? And the Admiral would know that. He'd be keenly aware of that. And so, and this is just the counterpoint. Again, I'm not saying I agree with it. So, knowing that they probably wouldn't do this, or better yet, if they did try it and the Federation stopped them butt cold, they might, unlike the Klingons, who would just take that as a provocation and say, well, we're all in now, double down. The Romulans would be like, retreat, retreat, danger, retreat. We don't want to pay the cost. And I think that is what he's at least banking on.
Am I the only one who heard exterminate, exterminate?
Okay, well, that's true. Yeah. Or like in the Coneheads movie, danger, danger, deflate. You know, well, that's what he's banking on.
My only counterpoint to your point is that policy can change very quickly.
That's right. But that's why I said banking.
Right.
I'm hoping that works.
I'm just saying, again, real world examples. We've just managed to shift policies 100% on Iran. We blew up one of their generals. We didn't do anything about a drone being shot down, but now we did something. So I'm saying we can shift in the real world.
You're absolutely right. That's what I'm saying.
Earlier you brought up this whole thing about being dynamorphic and characters, and it's like, yeah, we're going with the Romulans being cowards and not wanting a fight, but then could they have changed, or could they now have an advantage?
Well, that's right, and that's why I'm saying I'm not going to go ahead and say nope, I'm right. I'm just right. throwing out the opposite.
And I'm also
point.
Saying he's.
I'm leaning towards your point of view.
Right. I'm just saying. Also, as an admiral, you don't know everything. You don't.
No,
know.
You don't. And yeah. I'm leaning towards your point of view on that. I'm just trying to say, get into his head, and say this is what he thinks, and this is what he's hoping for.
Admiral Zhurok, I'm going to say he got a blind spot. His daughter, his child gave him a blind spot. He'd seen his fill of death. And this wasn't about preventing all future wars, like he says in his speeches. It was about preventing this war and hoping somebody else comes along to prevent the next war. If he was really about stopping all future wars, then what he should have done was pretend to toe the line while working behind the scenes to initiate a change within the Romulan military or within the Senate on Romulus. But again,
right.
It would have been difficult with the Tal Shiar out there running around rampant and everybody being terrified of it.
Right.
But I don't think he's got a win here. When he says, I did it all for nothing, even if he succeeds, he threw it all away for nothing because his daughter is still going to be at risk of growing up in a world of war because nothing changes
right.
from this.
My thought is, with your question, did he do something right? I think he had the right motivation, but I don't think he did the right thing.
I agree. Was it noble? Yes. Was it courageous? Yes. Was his cause just? Yes. Did it have a chance in the galaxy of being successful?
Not likely. No.
All it could do was delay this war.
He's lucky it panned out the way it did.
Yep. Yeah, okay. Yeah. So as we get ready to wrap this thing up, after that 2-hour and 47-minute crossover.
Yeah, we're going to go back to our regular length.
We try to get out of here right around 50 minutes to 60. While this is a study in Picard, this is a story. By this time in Next Generation, they were moving to this is a Data episode. This is a Picard episode. This is a Troy episode. While this is very much a Picard episode, it is very much a Data episode as well. And they start this out using that open, not only to set the tone for everything that's going to happen later with Zhurok and Picard and the whole story that's going to unfold.
Foreshadowing quite a bit, yeah.
They give you a chance to explore Data and his journey towards being human. And you get to talk about, where Picard says there's no better way to explore the human condition than Shakespeare. And he's probably right, because Shakespeare really was writing about the big issues of the human question
of his time.
What motivates us? Yeah, in the way that he could. And I mean, that's what makes Shakespeare so timeless. He's writing about qualities of being human.
Yeah.
And it makes him timeless. It makes the bard great. It's why his stories find readers centuries later and ultimately millennia later by the time it's all said and done.
Because what he's talking about is, again, what Star Trek talks about, human condition, the idea of what makes in this case, what makes the king great? You know, what makes, you know, this king a king?
And what makes the king, he says, you know, I think he is but a man.
Right.
You know, nakedness, he is but a man.
Right. What's in a ruler or a leader? What makes a leader a leader?
Right. Very and much this so. Lets Data explore questions both of the point of view of a soldier and the point of view of a leader, and to understand motivations of human beings even more so.
I was going to say, it was part of it was trying to understand humans and having emotions, which Geordi gives him a lesson about with his gut feeling and something that for Data is not fathomable. The gut feeling, what is that? And he finally gets it at the end with, oh, so you reach the conclusion with facts and your gut feeling, a synthesis of the two. Right. He comes to that conclusion, but of course he doesn't understand it.
And he's saying, I fill in the missing pieces. You make a decision as much based on fact and intuition. Fact is intuition, and you fill in the missing pieces, because Geordi says we never have all the facts. So, and he says it's filled in with intuition. It's based as much on that as it is facts. But if it's based on intuition, what he's realizing is it's based as much on the man as it is the facts.
And well, I feel bad for Data about that, because he comes to that realization, and then there's almost, you could assume, the realization of, I can't do that.
Well, here's.
But then he tries to.
Yeah. Well, this is the thing, I think.
Yeah, but he knows he can't.
He's sitting in 10 forward, and Admiral Zharok is like, and go to where you were going. But Admiral Zharok says, then why are you invading on my privacy? And I'm trying to figure out what my guts tell me about you.
Right. Well, this is the thing, I think. Okay, gut feelings, in my opinion, it's your subconscious sometimes. And cue me out when I think many times our subconscious sees things we don't.
Oh, it sure does. It's way ahead of us.
Right. True. Our conscious mind will focus on one thing and completely miss something else.
There's a lot of studies in neurology that basically says that our subconscious mind is in charge, and we only think our conscious mind has made those decisions.
Right. And our subconscious is leading us to where we go, because the subconscious pays attention and notices a million things we don't consciously notice. Mm-hmm. And our subconscious will pick up on things. And little movements, you know, little ticks that someone has. Like when you're talking to someone, when you go, why do I have an uncomfortable feeling around this person? Why is that? Because you picked up subconsciously on some tick or some movement or something they were doing. And your conscious mind does not notice that, but your subconscious notices it and gives you that gut feeling, something's wrong here.
Scott, sometimes I wonder why you didn't have that about certain individuals we know. Like when you wake up and they're right next to you using your computer and they just walk down into your bedroom. And why your intuition wasn't screaming
no
at
names,
you.
Please. Yeah. No names, please. But at
but
any
the
rate,
guilty parties know they are, and why Scott didn't go, wait a minute.
Why are you on my computer in my bedroom while I'm sleeping?
I'm not speaking to you ever again, you Looney Tune.
But, you know, it's a Data story, and you get that fantastic scene where he's talking to Admiral Zharok, and then he takes him to the holodeck, and Data thinks he's helping him. And in that android mind, he says, I'll bring Romulus to you. And the reality is already setting in for Zharok. He goes to order water, and it's the wrong scale, and he's, you know, whatever the cold water is, and there's no Romulan ale. Data's like, oh, I'll help. And in trying to help him feel more comfortable, he slams home the reality of everything that he's lost. And then, you know, at one point he looks at him and says, the cold logic of an android. Data's trying to do what his guts tell him he should do.
But he doesn't have one. He doesn't have intuition.
But what's really funny is, Data's got the right decision. For all of Geordi's human intuition, he has that moment where he says, we're going to catch the Romulans with their pants down at Nelvana 3.
And he doesn't get metaphor.
Right. But Data says... The evidence at this point says he is not a defector. Mm-hmm. And that he's not telling the truth.
Right.
Data says there's nothing there. He's not telling the truth. He doesn't have valid information. And Data's right. Data's seen through all of it. His logic has grasped it all, even without intuition.
Well, here's the thing. I don't think... when I said intuition is the subconscious, Geordi is not really working with all the facts.
Nope.
So because of that, I don't think, again, his intuition could get the right answer, because he's just going with the facts he's got. He's going with the information he has.
Yep.
He's going to go, oh, we got this. If he had more information, his gut feeling might be telling him no.
Yep.
And I think that's what we always work with, is limited information. And this is a very good episode for that, because
it's a great exploration of the human condition again about how you operate with limited information.
Well, and then too, we see an example of Data's lack of intuition when Picard asks him, "I want you to chronicle everything that's happening because you will be cold and dispassionate.
Mm-hmm.
You will just cite the facts." And so that also must have been a slight blow to Data, who's trying to figure out humanity, but then being reminded, well, you're not human, so you're perfect to record this.
And, you know, I said I try to find episodes that highlight the acting ability of the cast. Brent Spiner should have had a lot more work than he ever got. Playing Data is one of the trickiest things you will ever do. You have to come across as an emotionless android who doesn't portray emotion. But at the same time, you have to convey a childlike wonder. And a desire to want to be human. You're playing Pinocchio.
Yeah.
You want to be a real boy.
Pinocchio without emotions.
But you don't even have emotions. But then you have to hint at actually, I've always said, I did a standalone podcast on this, that Data has very simple emotions. What he doesn't have is complex emotions. To want to be human requires a basic emotion to desire something.
Right.
That's an emotion.
Well, I would agree with you, because I look at Data as not a unemotional character, even from the beginning, because you're absolutely right. Even when he's not portraying emotions, he has emotions.
Right. He doesn't have complex emotions.
Right.
He doesn't have emotions. He can never be depressed. He can never be sad or happy. But he has some real basic level emotions that, you know, he has to be the character. But in this episode, it's Brent Spiner at his best. And I brought up this a couple times, hinting at it. It's time to bring off Chekhov's gun here and fire it. When Geordi says, "With your pants down," there's this wonderful moment where Spiner's like, "With his pants down?" Like, he can't, he's like, what? It's just so lost. And it's that wonderful, you see the sense of wonder, you see the sense of trying to understand, realizing he needs to figure this out to be more human, but being totally lost in it. And he conveys it without emotion, but he conveys it with just enough in there to make you see
where he's going.
He's confused.
Right.
Which is an emotional state.
Yep.
Which again, you're right. This shows excellent acting on both his part and Picard. You're looking at three very good actors in this, you know, episode.
And then go back to the first scene where Data's reading Shakespeare. So what you're getting here, he can't give the performance with the emotion of a human, because it would be, he has to tone it down. But he also can't give it in a robotic thing. So Brent Spiner is trying to find the way to deliver a Shakespearean scene in the way that an aspiring, learning, local play actor would, but still coming across slightly flat and without the emotion, like he's faking emotion.
Right, and he's also playing a character who's showing emotion, almost like faking emotion.
Right.
And it would be very tricky to portray faking something like that.
He's acting below what he can, but making it look like he's doing as best he can. And he's playing a character.
Yeah.
It's Brent Spiner playing Data, playing Henry V.
Yeah. That is some acting chops.
While trying to give it the appearance of emotion, but not able to give it the appearance of emotion because he doesn't understand it. And he nails it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's as good as Stewart is in this episode. Spiner's better.
Well, because Stewart doesn't have to pretend like he's an emotionless person. In fact, he is Shakespearean, so he's almost in his wheelhouse.
Right. Spiner has the tougher job. He always has the tougher job in every single episode.
Yeah. And overlooked many times, you're right. Wow.
And this is him at his finest. This is an episode where it all comes together.
I can see why you definitely picked this episode.
Yeah. You've got a fantastic story from Ronald Moore. This is the second story he ever did, and it put Ron Moore onto the permanent writing staff, and he stayed there through the end of Deep Space Nine. And it launched him. And there's a reason that they realized he had that talent and brought him on as a full-time writer. He came on as a spec script with another episode, and I can't remember what it is right now. And then this was his second writing. So it's an excellent script. Ron Jones gets fired after this season, the music director. Rick Berman fired him when he took over in 4. Jones's music is fantastic to set the mood the whole time. The score is great. You have fantastic acting. You have a great guest appearance. And it's a powerful story that explores the human condition and what our motivations as a people are, how we make decisions, and what drives us to act the way we do in our own morality. To me, this is as good an episode of science fiction as you're going to get. And it doesn't make everyone's list, but I think if people sat down and watched it more and really deconstructed it, it probably would. Right. So are we ready to rate this?
Yeah.
Who wants to kick it off? How many glasses of Romulan ale? Do you want to give this thing?
Oh, we're giving it some strong stuff, are we?
Yeah, I give it an 8. I mean, I don't know what else to say. For everything we've mentioned, I give it an 8.
I think I also give it an 8. Excellent episode of Star Trek.
Well, it better be high up on your list, Scott, if you put it on your top.
I'm going to give it a 9.75. It is, you know...
What's it lacking? Just say what it's lacking, because we already know what you like.
It's not really lacking anything. And that's where I just don't want to throw a 10 out to throw a 10 out. But you know what? These are the 4 best episodes of series, so I'm going to alter it. It's a 10. There's nothing I can take away from this episode to take points off of it. It is everything that Star Trek The Next Generation was supposed to be. Resolving the conflict without violence. Outthinking your opponent. Exploring the depths of the human condition. It's got everything. It's got fantastic acting. As a piece of Star Trek, it's a 10 out of 10. As a piece of science fiction, maybe it's a 9 out of 10. But this is a fantastic episode with a lot of rewatchability, and it's fun.
And my rating would probably honestly be higher if I knew all of Star Trek Next Gen better. Because I'm not you, Scott, who have watched Star Trek Next Generation probably 20 million times.
And it's just, it's a quintessential portrayal of Picard. And they're the two central characters in Next Gen.
All right.
It's everything. You know, if I wanted to show you something to say, go watch more, this would be the episode I'd probably say. Next week, Tapestry. Flowers, John Luke Pickard. Rage Master. What's left for them to do?
Stay sick, sickies.
That was our first review of the episode. We reviewed The Defector. It's Scott's favorite with a Romulan, and Data learns about emotion.